Hello, this is Zsófilter, the feminist podcast of Partizan, the leading independent media channel in Hungary. My name is Zsófi Balog, and my guest today is Fajka Elnagasi, who is visiting from Vienna, Austria. She is a political scientist and former member of parliament in Austria with over 30 years of experience advocating for women's rights. Fajka has just launched a new organization called Athena Forum, a European initiative fighting for sex-based rights and democratic values. Co-authored with Anna Zobnina, she also just published a report on how gender ideology has captured European institutions, and that is what we will be discussing today. Our international listeners, welcome to Partizan's podcast channel. You can find out more about us on our social media platforms, and if you can, please support our work through the links in the description. Fajka, good to have you here, fellow troublemaker. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for the invitation, Zsófi. I'm really happy to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, me too, absolutely. And I've been very excited about your new initiative, Athena Forum. But before we talk about that, let's go back to 2022, when we first met here in Budapest. And the reason why we met is because there was the European Lesbian Conference, the ELC, held in Budapest at the time. And you were about to attend, but they disinvited you basically the night before or something, and supposedly because of your gender critical views. At the time, you were a member of parliament, as I said in the intro, but a lot has happened to you in the last 3 years. So please talk about that. What have you been up to?
it's been a long road, a long path to get to where I am now. And it was quite painful in between. And it would be, you know, it would not be true to just brush over it and to discard it as not relevant or not deeply painful. So when I was here in Budapest 3 years ago, I was basically banned as a lesbian woman from attending a lesbian conference. But not only as a lesbian, I was a member of parliament with the Greens, but I was also a lesbian activist for a very long time. And I was active with the organization that was organizing this conference. And I really think that was a mistake from their side. Now, I've been also active on their board before, and we've had discussions already coming up about similar issues. And the position that we've taken back then was to make sure that we're not policing other women and other lesbians. So up until that point, there was an effort made to try and make this a space for different women with their different positions to come together. Because if you start policing on one issue, what stops you also from policing on other issues? And this is also something that's quite fundamental to the understanding of who is a lesbian. But many things followed from that, because if you take a position like this as an organization, you signal something to others. So it was not only about me, it was a position that they took and a signal that they sent out. So they basically said, if you're a lesbian with certain beliefs, you're not welcome here in this space. And we monopolize that space as a very big lesbian network and organization. And we are the ones to define who may belong in that space and who's excluded from it. And this sets a precedent then also for others, for other organizations, and also for individual activists. And shortly after this, there was an open letter against me on my national level, signed by politicians from my own party and also politicians from other parties. And this is also, when you do an open letter, it is highly performative. So it's not to actually have a discussion. It's not to actually have a conversation. Nobody called me. Nobody asked me about my thoughts or my positions or my beliefs. But everybody was very fast, or it seems that they were very fast, to add their names to a public performance.
Let me jump in here just for a second, sorry, because I think people who are not familiar with what we're talking about, I don't want to spend too much time explaining it from the beginning, but basically this kind of action, like an open letter, is familiar to me, or maybe my followers at Zsófilter, because sometimes organizations here, LGBT organizations, would put up an open letter or like a post about me or my shows because of my beliefs or of my supposed crimes that I commit against the so-called community. So, and that's how some people in the public might meet your name or my name. They just see something. Oh my God, there's this person who committed something, and there is support backing this open letter saying we have to condemn whatever she said or did. But it's not very clear what exactly your crime is or my crime is. So in your case, what was your crime?
Well, I said publicly that there is a difference between what I then called trans women and biological women. And I said that we also had to look at the harms done to children and minors, adolescents, by transitioning, medically transitioning them. And I also talked about the rights of same-sex attracted people to be same-sex attracted and not same-gender attracted. And I also addressed the dynamics overall within this sphere and within certain communities. And I had quite deep insight into these communities as I've been a long-time activist myself. So about the dynamics that will then immediately try to defame you, harm your reputation, and make you out to be an evil person that is transphobic, but also racist, and also at that point it could also be anti-Semitic. That has shifted by now. And in a broader sense, just an evil, bad person that is somehow aligned with the far right and is a fascist. And that will happen within 5 minutes. And so one of my, main worries about this has always been that this is something that uses one individual that is publicly there and says things that many might agree with. And this is used not only to isolate that individual, but as a warning to others. So with the isolation, of course, others then become more hesitant to think similar things and especially to say them because they see the consequences. And they see not only that they are blamed or maybe, given certain names, but also that the community that they think that they belong to is not an actual community. It comes with conditions. And this conditionality of belonging is something, when you see it exemplified like this, that is very shocking to me. So I was also addressing this dynamic. And I mean, all of this is something that has been with me since then and kept coming up in incident over incident with attacks from within my own party, from the NGO sector, the trans activists, from media sometimes also. And then has intensified and eventually led me to then also leave politics, but not only politics, but also my own party.
Right. I also wanted to ask you about that because you've been basically ousted from your party, if I understand correctly, or it was kind of made impossible for you to stay. And it's also relating to this issue and these supposed crimes. I think it's very interesting what you said about community, and it's not actually a community because as a lesbian myself, I always felt like, well, I don't feel like I'm in a community, but I do feel like certain organizations are supposed to represent me because they say we represent lesbians and gays and homosexuals and all that. At the same time, if you think differently than whatever the accepted doctrine is, then suddenly you are ousted. You are not allowed in the community anymore. So to me, it's more like a religious organization more than a human rights organization.
Yeah. I mean, community has become a totally irritating term to me by now because it is something that works on this emotional level, but it completely conceals the conditions that it goes by. So it would be more honest to call it even a political party than you have a party program or an organization that has certain convictions. But to just lump everybody together in a community that keeps growing and growing and growing, and now we're put together in a group that most people are not able to pronounce the acronym for anymore. So LGBT or LGBTIQ or LGBTIQ plus. And because of this acronym also getting more and more complex and complicated, many people will then just say queer, the queer community. But then really, if you look at it, you can neither define it nor is it in any sense a community. But of course, we would like to have communal spaces. We would like to have opportunities to come together socially, and maybe also even politically. But that has become very difficult for lesbians that insist that they are women and that they are same-sex attracted.
And they don't want males in their spaces, in their dating life, in their dating pool. The same for women, feminists, or just women who do not want males in their spaces. And it's
and there is nothing right-wing or fascist about that.
Absolutely.
And not even transphobic, I would say. It's just to have it as a legitimate demand to have your own space, even when the others do have their spaces, and that's never questioned.
That is very interesting because as I was reading this report, you were talking about the so-called Big Five, these big LGBT institutions that are very influential in Europe. And these, some of these organizations started as grassroots organizations in the 80s, like ILGA or IGLIO. And in their names, they still carry their history, which of course is now rewritten. And in their websites, they are only listing LGBTQ people as the community they represent, but actually ILGA is the International Gay and Lesbian Association. IGLIO is the International Gay and Lesbian Youth Organization. And then there is the trans organization TGEU. And just thinking about these organizations, you see that it was actually a normal thing in Hungary also to have different organizations for different interests, different interest groups, for gays, for lesbians, for trans people, etc. But as we know, in the last 10 years, I would say, this accelerated so quickly, this kind of phenomenon that you are not allowed to meet separately as lesbians, or you're not allowed to have the desire to only meet with lesbian women. And I'm often told that I want to exclude people, and I hate people because I don't want to meet them. And of course, that is a very childish interpretation of what I'm actually saying, which used to be a normal thing to have for lesbians to have their own spaces, for gay men to have their own spaces, for trans people to have their, because they have different interests, and of course they can have mixed spaces if they want. They can have mixed parties, but whoever wants to should have the option to meet separately without being targeted as some kind of Nazi, as we know. Which, honestly, to an adult, intelligent person, seems like common sense, and it used to be common sense. To me, it's fascinating how quickly it became impossible to even have this desire, or to speak out loudly about your desire to be wanting to meet with lesbians only as a lesbian.
I mean, to be fair, you know, it was always difficult to carve out the space for lesbians within mixed organizations. The mixed organizations were always dominated by men, and women and lesbians had to make the case to have a separate, if there was a mixed conference, a separate session, one workshop, one session that was for lesbians, or maybe even a separate conference. And I remember those discussions and those fights from decades back. So it was always a struggle. And this misogyny that you will have in society in general, you will also find within the LGB context. And so we have many issues that even as lesbians and gays, we agree upon, and we have many where we disagree. And so sometimes you can avoid these issues, but sometimes you clearly know that there is conflict around them. And these are very concrete advocacy issues also. So it's not only about social needs and how you would like to engage with each other in a social space or when you party, but even, you know, marriage for all was something that was not seen as a priority by everybody in the political LGB movement. There were different approaches that were discussed at one point. But then there are other issues that remain completely unaddressed and unresolved, such as prostitution or surrogacy or pornography. And where I would say that there is a big divergence, actually, between the interests of most gay men and those of most lesbian women. And many lesbian women, not all of them, but many are also feminists and have a feminist position on top of their identity around their sexual orientation. And you do not necessarily find that with gay men. So there are these areas of conflict, and if you know about them, then you can have maybe productive discussions around it. But in the moment when you institutionalize your grassroots movement and it becomes an organization that is so strongly embedded within other institutions, such as the European level, the supranational level, when there is funding, when there are positions, paid positions, staff positions, and priorities to decide upon where the money, the funding goes on, then it becomes a manifest conflict. And in this conflict, lesbians lost. Because lesbians have been redefined even by the lesbian organization that exists as part of these top five as anybody who identifies as a lesbian, including clearly men who say that they are lesbians. So that is just outrageous. And it is a deep betrayal of same-sex attracted people, specifically of lesbians. And these big organizations, such as ILGA Europe, that, as you say rightly, do carry the name lesbian gay still, the words lesbian and gay still in their name, they go even further and they are redefining in policy documents the terminology, and they move from same-sex attracted to same-gender attracted individuals. So as if it was completely trivial who we were attracted to. If I'm only attracted to an individual, then does not make me same-sex attracted. I'm same-sex attracted for a reason. So there is deep betrayal by these organizations who have in the last years focused almost exclusively on a trans activist agenda. So even if they're not trans organizations by their own definition, or some are, they are trans activists. And they are the ones who are pushing for advocacy points that relate to trans activist demands. Because also at the same time, most legal barriers to equality, anti-discrimination have been achieved for lesbians and gays in most Western European countries. So there is not much more to press for with urgency. But if you want to continue in your relevance and with your power and with your influence and with in terms of resources, you have to make something urgent. And so they are focusing in on this group that they would also call queer, but does not really mean lesbians and gays, but would then mean, would be broadened to not only mean trans, but also non-binary, also sometimes asexual, aromantic, pansexual, queer in an undefined way. So you just add something for all those whom you might have forgotten. And you lump that together and then you make outrageous policy demands around the assumed needs of these groups and you turn it into a human rights framework.
Let's talk about these policy demands. I think it's very interesting to learn about the history of this. So I think most of the gender criticals who I've been talking to over the past years put it around, me included, put it around 2015 when a big shift has happened. And I talked to Kate Harris from the LGB Alliance and Robert Wintem, you two, who say, yes, Stonewall, who they used to be leading members of or active members of, consciously made a decision in 2015 to turn from the issue of, or the focus of gay marriage when it was achieved to trans issues and this kind of policy. And then in Europe, you lay down in the report, it's really an excellent analysis, how it started not 10, but more like 20 years ago in the mid-2000s when the Yogyakarta principles were drafted and gained traction. But then these big five organizations became more institutionalized, got more funding, started to hire paid activists and so on. And then they started to really target the UN organizations and European level organizations to push for gender identity to be included included in non-discrimination clauses and all kinds of policy papers that deal with discrimination. And to my big, I don't know how to say this, it's a big tragedy, I think, that the Istanbul Convention in 2011, when it was finalized, ILGA Europe, if I'm correct, was pushing and was successful in pushing gender identity into the non-discrimination clause, which is the Istanbul Convention, of course, is a very, very important paper, piece of document, which was not ratified in Hungary, for example, because the government accuses it of being a backdoor for gender identity ideology. And I want to say they are wrong because the entire document is not about that. But at the same time, I have to say they are kind of also right, because there is a big push for sex-based rights to be overwritten by gender-based rights. And of course, the word gender has different meanings now than it used to. Long story short, women pay the price in a lot of policy decisions that are relating to gender identity. So please talk about this, like the mid-2000s and how this kind of policy making about gender identity crept into the European institutions.
Yeah. I think there are two important aspects of this. One is that these organizations, they by then appeared to, let's say, decision makers, legislators, institutions, as trusted actors. So they were known, and they were believed to be something that organically belonged to the lesbian and gay rights movement. So many contacts were already established, and they had opened doors to the institutions. So this is what they were building on, and this is something that drives them to this day. And the other thing is that it was basically, and it still is, and also that's one of the reasons why we're also coming in, like a playground to them. A playground where they were completely unsupervised, unmonitored, and they could do whatever they wanted to do. So when they would bring in their demands or their positions, so that means they were the ones sitting at the round tables, in expert meetings, in hearings and consultations. It was only their perspective that was considered. And they could bring in the most outrageous demands without any scrutiny from the other side. And this is a very dangerous situation, because that's how we now end up with propositions by the European Commission. So that's not coming from an NGO, by the European Commission that says they want to promote self-ID without age restrictions across Europe or across the EU. So if you would apply scrutiny to something that says self-ID without age restrictions, initially you would, you know, want to look at it a bit more precisely and see what does that mean. How would you want a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old, an 8, 10, or 12-year-old to decide their legal sex and to organize society around the possibility to do so? But there is a lack of responsible dealing with these very emotionally loaded visions and demands that come from this group that is imagined as this queer community. So this is one of the ways that all of this has seeped in around 26, 27. The Yogyakarta principles were formulated and then presented to the public. But already by 2010, they were referenced by European institutions. And there are different ways for this to, for how this became so successful. So one is this a certain kind of attractiveness of a field that is seen to be, these are the outsiders. These are the outsiders that are now turning the power dynamics. They are coming in and they will empower themselves, and we can be allies to them when they do that. And
the
they
oppressed
are,
groups.
The oppressed groups. Yeah. But this oppressed group is particularly attractive because it has your best friend, gay man, and at the same time, it has this straight guy who just loves to wear a feather boa And this other guy who is maybe bisexual and really loves to put on makeup and does it so much better than you do. So there's some, it's never about the women, the lesbians are never the ones who are attractive to them. But there is something interesting, something, you know, very peculiar about this group and the way that they bring in their demands. There's also a lot of, you know, social networking going on. We also describe a little bit of that in the report. There is a very influential group within European Parliament that is called the LGBTIQ Intergroup, which consists of more than 100 members of European Parliament and is very activist-driven. So when you have institutionalized networks like that, they are a support to your work and to your lobbying and to your intentions. And so by 2010, when the Council of Europe started to reference the Yogyakarta principles, and then also the Fundamental Rights Agency, which is the main human rights agency of the European Union, this became something like a normalization of this referencing of a complete fantasy document. The Yogyakarta principles have no legally binding power whatsoever. It's a fantasy document put together on an island by a handful of people, and it became a true success story. And so up until today, even just very recently, the European Parliament made a resolution referencing the Yogyakarta principles. It has become normalized to think of it as part of a human rights framework and a human rights standard. And this is also partially due to personal relations and to a movement of individuals from the civil society sector or from the lobby groups to the institutions, then to various places within the institutions. So this is something that's quite normal to happen throughout the course of maybe 10 or 15 years and as part of one's political career, but it also brings the ideology with it. And the problem is that until now, very few have been able to put themselves out there and call this out for the ideology that it is. It is something that's harmful, not only to specific groups, children and adolescents and women and lesbians, but it is dogmatic in its approach, and it contradicts reality. And this is something that is being continuously codified, as you say, by amending, for example, the Istanbul Convention or other relevant laws on the national level, or just by introducing these concepts as terminology throughout all kinds of fields. So there is an interest in mainstreaming this understanding of gender identity. So by now, you will find gender identity as if it is an actual thing in many policy documents on the supranational level, but also on the national level in countries across Europe.
Let's name some of these realities that this movement is refusing to face, because I think people, as you said, have this kind of feel about this issue. Like they can sense, like the average person on the street, they can sense it's something, it's very touchy, it's very sensitive, very hard to talk about, better just avoid it altogether. But if I have to, I have to be very careful how I say things. And I know that I cannot really ask questions, or I have to be very careful how I ask questions, because I see people who are going against this are immediately, you know, piled upon online or something. But what we are actually talking about is the idea that that a person can change sex or not. Obviously, changing sex is impossible. It's a fantasy, a subjective feeling, whatever you feel inside about yourself, whatever you feel like, calling it maybe a gender expression, is how the kids call it today. But basically, what we are talking about is men and women, you know, being feminine or masculine in how they present in the world. And some people took this idea to the extreme where they say, I am so feminine as a man that I'm actually a woman. Like, I am actually biologically a woman. And they will say this, some of the activists. Now, Today, it's very varied how a trans person can feel inside. They don't have to have an operation. They don't have to go to a psychiatrist for 2 years or so. They don't have to have a waiting period. And, you know, young people can just have this idea that they can block their own puberties and get medication for it. So there's like a whole entire variety of industries that this will affect. And of course, a whole bunch of issues regarding to not just psychology, but also, you know, your health and how you can move in the world, if you can have spaces for women in prisons or not, and so on. I touched on a lot of topics, but basically, I think this is the thing that is so overwhelming. If you want to touch this, you are touching this overwhelming amount of interconnected ideas and doctrines. And there is no space. There is no space to be critical. Like, I can say this because I've been, and I think you will agree that as somebody who has been, you know, watching this for 5 or 10 years, there is just no space to express your critical thoughts or questions. So I think, and because it crept into all the institutions and law as well, you have a sense like, well, I'm not, I cannot question this. Everything supports this
idea. And some countries you cannot question it.
Yeah.
And some countries you cannot call a man without facing police charges, maybe.
Yeah,
but I think we've trained people quite well, and I think this is a problem of the left, because I think most people on the right will not find it so difficult to address these issues or to talk about them. But we've trained people from a certain political context very well in being afraid to ask certain questions and to say certain things. Now, everything around this trans issue is somehow connected to sexuality and something around sexuality, but I don't think that that's the main inhibition. But it's a bit of a continuation of when you have lesbians and gays, do not ask too many questions, you know, keep a distance, be polite, but also in other areas, don't ask where somebody's from, don't ask them where they're really from. Yeah, and these are questions that I know very well, you know, but we've come to this point where you've created a gap where there are thoughts and there are discussions to have, and then you have individuals maybe, or you have a societal context, and then there is this gap that you cannot bridge. You cannot find a way to just take one of these issues, one that's maybe relevant to you, could be social transitioning of children in schools, because you might be a parent, or you could have kids in school, or you're a teacher maybe. Could be other aspects of it. But to know that somehow your speech could be offensive, and you could then face retaliation because of that. If you leave all of that aside, there should be nothing shameful or defamatory about calling a man. And even in the case of there being conflict, because this man might think of himself as a woman, you still should be able to express that you see and you know this to be a man. But when you've managed to create a part in the political spectrum that cannot even go there mentally, let alone talk about it, you will have a terrible political divide in society, because it will still be talked about, but the only ones who will do that talking are from the right. And they might do it in a way that's even more aggressive or disrespectful than it would be if we would have this conversation very openly and look at what does self-ID specifically mean. Why do political parties subscribe to this idea? I know that the Greens, for example, and that's the case for the European Greens, but also the Greens in Austria, but also in many other countries, they are trying to sell people on the idea that it is a human right to choose your sex. So the free choice of one's sex know, however this is worded, it is so weird to just make up something and put it into a human rights framework and try to make it sound as if it was a human right. I could just say the human right to do podcasts. You know, and then I will...
I advocate for that.
Yeah. That's why I would suggest it to you. Well, then imagine a political party, you know, keep repeating and repeating and repeating it. And it sounds somehow vaguely familiar. It has the same language and terminology. And then you've also been made, very cautious of approaching these subjects. So then you end up... as a parent or maybe an educator, unable to tell the reality and the truth to young children or young adults, because you would say, you know, I mean, children often ask, is this a man or a woman? When they're very young or when there's some ambiguity. And you should be able to tell them and not to say, well, I don't know. You would have to ask that person. And just think about what you're actually doing if you're then communicating this to children, that it is actually something that they really cannot know and cannot tell, and have to consult the individual in question to get that piece of information. So we're making things that are extremely absurd, and the longer those on the left are silent about it, and they are complicit in making this gap bigger and bigger, that at the same time, you know, is useful to those on the right, because, you know, I mean, they are the ones that not only standing up apparently for women's rights, but also for free speech, democratic participation. But at the same time, it is also very useful for the trans activists, because they can make use actually really of this unmonitored, unsupervised playground. And so, you know, one of the things we're trying to do, and so with Athena, we say it's for sex-based rights, democratic values, and political courage, is to remind those in politics that they have to find their courage somewhere. There have been so many already who've put themselves out there to address these issues. It is not niche, and it is not something to ignore. It is not something that's so difficult to find words about. And there are many that they could now also ask and consult if they truly wouldn't know how to address the demands of the activists.
And I think there is a very nasty tactic of the trans activists, which is to basically threaten death of people if you are critical. I want to address this because this is something I face all the time when I make interviews about this topic, is that I am endangering people's lives. Like, this is what they actually say. And I'm sure you've met this kind of reaction. It's not that I cannot be critical because my ideas are, I don't know, awful. It's even further. I'm actually harming people. I'm actually endangering people. I'm actually, like, some people will not come to talk to me. I repeatedly invited people from the trans activist side and their supporters. They would not come, some of them, because they tell me specifically that if they come to talk to me, even if they would themselves want to talk, they would endanger their communities and their lives and their well-being. And I mean, I would laugh if it was not so tragic and dangerous and insane what this actually means. This actually means that they tell each other and tell themselves not to be resilient or not to be, open and strong enough to take criticism or different ideas that they might have, but that they should feel some people feel suicidal because of these gender critical views.
Well, they can say many things, and I think it's up to us to not, put the same power into their language that they think that they have also in other fields. So they believe that with a pure speech act, they can change their sex. And they believe then maybe that with speaking, we might erase their existence.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't believe in either of this. It's like a toddler throwing a tantrum. It's like we're stepping onto their playground and we're saying no to them about certain things. We're not indulging in their fantasies. It's an immersive role play. And if you refuse to participate, they throw a tantrum. So I do not subscribe to this belief. And if they want to hang on to it, you know, that's fine. We need to have a conversation with the adults that are willing to do something about a situation that is catastrophic and very harmful on so many levels. And everybody who goes through life with some awareness in Western European countries will see the effects. Many people of a certain age now have either children, grandchildren, nephews, nieces, friends of their children who are affected by this one way or another. Everybody who works in the educational field, in mental health, there are, even in the media, you know, I talk to journalists a lot and they will tell me, it is impossible for me to report about this. So they have an understanding of the pressure around it and of the unsayable things, of this omerta that lies upon so much of this, but still affects many. So I'm just trying to ignore this. Of course, you will often have events or organizations that will then not take place because they keep throwing their tantrums and they're just so loud and attention-seeking with it that they will affect others. And that's the whole motivation behind it. It is to get to you emotionally. But, I mean, you know, it is something that this is not unkind to not fall for it. And you know, you're clear about it, and I'm also clear about it. This is not about erasing the existence of trans-identified individuals. So you can just let someone have their tantrum and then see if it's possible to have a conversation with them after that.
Right. And I think we have to also acknowledge the fact, not we as in a general, we as a society, that this is an insanely sexist idea that if you're feminine enough as a man, if you put on lipstick, that makes you a woman. I mean, it's just it's just so insulting, I think, as a woman to listen to these arguments that they put forward. And at the same time being told that I'm the one who is a Nazi and offensive and endanger people because I don't agree with this. And just putting aside of how I feel, because it doesn't really matter of what I feel or say. But if this affects legislation or policymaking or women's spaces, now I have a real problem, and women have a real problem. And I think it's very comfortable, and it's a luxury to believe these things when people say, you know, these well-meaning progressives, if they repeat these mantras like, oh yes, we have to affirm everything, we have to affirm everybody, we cannot question whatever their gender identity is. Well, really? Well, you're not the one who has to go to a woman's shelter, or you're not the one who will put in a woman's prison and face a man there. And in Hungary, I think we're also very comfortable because it didn't play out as much because of our government as in other areas in Europe, in other countries. And you can talk about that, of course, a lot more than I can, because the government basically went ahead and against it altogether. And of course, in the meantime, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, as we say, because women's rights also went with it. And they are very conservative and right-wing and sexist as well. But I do think that progressives are also at fault, or we can call it the left or whatever, because they absolutely sacrificed women's sex-based protections, even if just on the level of their narrative, they do strengthen this argument in the public sphere of, well, who needs women's spaces? We're past that. That's an old idea. We're just inclusive everywhere. We're really Are you a domestic violence victim that needs space away from men? Like, are we really not taking women this seriously? I get so mad because it really shows how little we think of women's safety, because it is a safeguarding issue. And of course, we can talk about children too. Or you're not that parent who will face, like some parents will write me, like, can you recommend a psychologist who is not affirmative? Mm. Because I don't know where to take my daughter or my son who just came home with the idea that they are in a different gender than their body. I mean, what kind of idea is that to put in a child's head? So I just think people, as you said, just deal with it on the feeling level. But they, if they are not affected or they don't understand what it means to be affected, they just have this very comfortable viewpoint of this.
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely agree. And I would add one aspect to it. So not only is it extremely sexist, but it's also extremely homophobic.
Mm.
Because you're, I mean, of course, not all of them, but often you would have a very feminine boy who would grow up to be a gay man. And you would have lesbians who are maybe rather masculine women. And to then come in and say, well, we will go by certain kinds of behavior, play, interests, clothing maybe, mannerism. And then because of that, classify you the opposite sex. So that really goes into that field of what is called as transing the gay away. And I think you're very rightly mad at, you know, all those who are complicit in this. I'm especially outraged at, well, not only the left, but politicians. Mm. Because there's so much political laziness with those who have a responsibility to not turn activist demands into party programs. There is a difference between these two. And to just override these material realities on one hand, but these needs, these very clear needs, because they also have a hierarchy of people who they would like to listen to. And as you say, the actual feminists, when they voice their needs and their demands, they're at the bottom of that hierarchy. And on top are the trans activists, the queer identified people who are younger, edgier, much more attractive and interesting to listen to than these old boring feminists with their old boring demands that just make us feel uncomfortable. Because they challenge us differently and more, and as society as a whole, and they think it's a small thing to do, and we'll give them the affirmation from these groups or from a community, as they think, an imagined community. But I would also say that I think many women's organizations have also made themselves complicit with this. So there is a difficult dynamic because these institutionalized women's organizations, they are dependent on funding. And so in some countries, really, it will also be that the ideology comes in through the funding. But in many other countries and contexts, even before that becomes the main driving factor, you will have women's organizations changing their names and their focus and their reach because of some maybe young activists in the organization who make a suggestion, push for something, and who then demand to have a more inclusive feminism within these women's organizations who also think of themselves as feminist organizations. So then if you want to say, well, what feminism do I align myself with? The one that you have most present and also in a sense most active is queer feminism. And then you either risk conflict within your own organization in a broader sense, or you risk being attacked directly by your younger colleagues for basically just being an old bore. So you're an old woman, and I've been talking to many women that old in that sense is 50 plus, And I myself will turn 50 next year. So that's not really old, I think. But this is where you become basically redundant, and you can be made redundant within the organization. So for you to have legitimacy and to remain relevant, there's often the feeling that you have to cater to these, well, demands on you. And this is also where I put, older university professors who are just women or lesbians, who at one point now will define themselves as non-binary. And it is a way for them to connect with their students, to somehow feel young and to remain relevant and to not make themselves a target for accusations. And so this kind of complicity is on an individual level, but also on an organizational level. And when you have the women's organizations now becoming women asterisk organizations and betraying women and women's rights, you really ask yourself, where can I turn to? Where can I turn to within this complexity, where all of the organizations that I would rely on have completely abandoned reality and women's rights?
Completely agree. I'm very, very mad at the feminists and women's organizations that would either just avoid the topic altogether and self-censor and not just stay out of it and manage somehow without it, just turn. And I can also see how divided organizations are from the local level to the very big, like the European level umbrella organizations. I know from people who work there, and it would never get out in the open what kind of infighting there are. But it's just insane how this topic tore apart the feminist movement, I think, as a whole, to be honest. And my opinion was, when I was active in these organizations here in Hungary, that honestly, I don't give a shit about the funding. Like, we should not align our values to the funders. And of course, we can, strategize and get money and still keep our focus. And some of these organizations did and do. But some will just cater to these the inclusive language and cater to these demands of the funders to put up these expressions of inclusivity and all that. And as you said, the target group suffers. Women will suffer who need a place, if they need a place, to turn to, who they know will support them in their demand or desire to have a woman on the space. And how will they know that? There's no way to know that. If you don't specifically say, and of course there is a risk in saying that, I understand. You will risk your funding, you will risk your reputation. You might have to start all over again. But honestly, the reason I got into these organizations and the reason I looked up to them is because of how brave they were at the time when they started, from the bottom up, from nothing, from no money. And they had the courage to say, we don't care, we need a space for women, and we will provide services for them. And we understand why women need their own spaces.
Yeah. And I think there is this additional level that it actually... The silence and the complicity of the women's rights organizations, the big ones in the civil society field, it compromises the documents. It compromises policies, laws, because that's how you end up having gender identity put into all of these documents in different areas. But also that's how you have this move from sex to gender, or this conflation in terminology from sex with gender, an absolute confusion around it, because the women's organizations and many others also in the field of anti-racism, international development cooperation, there are many other fields that are equally complicit, but women's organizations, of course, are the ones who have a mandate to stand for the rights of women. And so it is a very real fear that they have that they might implode from internal conflict, that they might be smeared by the other organizations, their presumably sister and brother organizations that are not so sisterly after all, and that they might lose funding. So these are very real fears, but the more of them and the longer they are silent, the worse it gets, not only in terms of what's happening meanwhile, but also how difficult it is for others to shift anything, because then they stand alone. It would have been possible, and I think it's still possible, to stop all of this and to reverse some of it if they would find the courage to put themselves out there and the clarity to remember what their organization was set up to do initially and mainly. So the other side, the transactivists, they depend upon this silence and this complicity. And it is really sad to watch them all go down that route and, still pretend to have this understanding of themselves as somehow feminist, but it is completely watered down to the level of being unable to do or say anything.
And I feel like it comes down to being able to say no, basically.
Yeah.
It's just that simple. And the feminist movement used to understand this.
Yeah.
We have to teach women how to say no, even to someone within our own house or community. Within our own movement, if somebody wants to have mixed spaces, parties, communities, fine, go for it. I don't care. But what I do care about is if I want to choose a woman-only space, a lesbian-only space, I want to have the option. I don't want to be smeared for it. I don't want to be called a Nazi for it. I want an organization that will represent me in my desire to have a woman-only space. And I want courageous women to be loud and public about that.
Yeah.
Because I think, feminist courage used to be about this. Like, you say no to the religious bigots about their misogyny. You say no to Orbán's misogynist government. You say no to men who call themselves women. Why isn't that simple to just say, very sorry about your feelings, not more important than mine?
Yeah. And there is a lot of bullying going on also. Yeah. So, when I compare this to a playground, there is bullying. And then if you do not fulfill our wishes, we will call you names.
Yeah.
And I think we also need to develop this resilience towards the name calling. So now when somebody calls me right wing or fascist, I don't care much.
Me either. I these words
look,
have lost
look
all.
What has become of us.
I know. but it's true. You get it enough times and all you do is what? Talk about lesbians being lesbians and women wanting to date women. I mean, the absolute homophobia of this idea. And again, gay men are not as affected, of course, as we know, as lesbian women. Again, women pay the price. This idea, but I think about the lesbian women who will, with a straight face, tell me that they don't care if a so-called woman has a penis. And I just want to say, fuck you. Congratulations if you like the penis. Go for it. Honestly, don't care.
Yeah, congratulations if you're bisexual.
No problem. That's fine. Live your life. And I actually don't care about people's personal lives. I don't care how they identify. I don't honestly don't give a shit. But don't make this into law that a man can call himself a woman and come into a space where I want to go as a woman. And if it's a woman-only space or a lesbian-only space, I don't have the right to call him out. And I will be the one removed, or you're the one removed from a lesbian conference that you used to be a board member of as a lesbian. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of the young women who are just coming out and are looking for a space to socialize in. So the young lesbians. And you will have many of these lesbian youth groups that are opened up to men, often even of, you know, whatever age. And it, they create an environment where they push it on these young women in a you know, time where they just experience many things for the first time, that this is something that they have to accept. And that is part of what it means to be a lesbian. So this I find, you know, really dangerous and violent and harmful. And especially so because I cannot imagine, you know, a person with any level of self-awareness, a man with any level of self-awareness, would not go to attend such a group. So there are mixed youth groups that you could go to. So what's driving you if you would, if you still go and attend this group? So it's a specific kind of men on top of it. And young lesbians are then to spend their time with them and to basically, you know, flatter their egos and affirm their fantasies and so-called identities. And I think this is also an organizational failure, but bigger than that, because these youth groups, many of them, they receive funding. And they receive funding with quite some transparency around it. So they would have to write a report. They would describe their youth group. They would be proud to describe the youth group as inclusive. And you have also not for lesbians, just for girls, girls clubs, social, with social workers, girls cafes and similar. And they would all add the asterisk. They would all boast about how inclusive they are. And this is clear to funders, and the funders in that case, that's state funding. So there is really a lack of institutional scrutiny and responsibility, how you're dealing with young people in very vulnerable sectors, such as social work, mental health, school settings, education in general. To have boundaries and to understand that it's important to have these boundaries also, assured for the target group that you work with. But there are certain things that have become unthinkable in a leftist or progressive context. So one is to say woman, or worse, even to say what a woman is. One is anything to do with biology. Just to mention it, just to say biological woman, you're basically an essentialist, you're essentializing, and that's just one step away from eugenics. And then it's also boundaries. Boundaries in any sense. So you have to advocate for no border, no nation. That's on an ideological level. One aspect, but you also cannot draw any kind of boundaries about any issue. So whether, even if you take self-ID on board, you cannot draw a boundary and set an age limit. If you talk about, would it make sense to maybe have an age or a limit around sex education in schools, you cannot bring yourself to say anything because it might be wrong. It might be contested. It appears to be bigoted to want to draw a line and to have boundaries. And I think that's it's a shame, really, that the left seems to have lost this ability. I don't know if they ever really had it, but in some aspects, they were quite good at setting, prohibitions or understanding good and bad. But there is no internal value system that allows progressives to draw from. Yeah. So to understand why is it wrong to have sex education pushed on four-year-olds? Why is it wrong to have ideology in schools in a way that does not allow you to reflect upon ideology, but basically feeds your ideology? why are you not able to distinguish between lesbians and gays and then the whole trans issue? And if you have no moral guidance and your own political positions are too weak to understand and contextualize the complexities of this world, then you will embarrass yourself with the politics that you do. But also you are left to use something as a guiding compass. And that has become with the Greens, but also with others, very often this idea of autonomy, of individual autonomy and self-determination. So it's also very close to self-ID. In other languages, it's the laws are called self-determination laws. So you have this idea that an individual can self-determine itself fully without restrictions whatsoever and completely. And that is how we will build our understanding, our political understanding of what we, you know, what we're supporting and what we're not supporting. We will put this into a political framework. This will substitute any kind of ideology that we lack, or reasonable ideology that we lack. And I think that just shows how what a failure big parts of the left have become. And they also don't use any feminist analysis, though most political parties would say on the left that they are feminist parties. They would say that in the blink of an eye, of course we are a feminist party, but they will not actually ground anything in a feminist analysis. Queer feminism is just a slogan feminism. It's an influencer feminism. So if this is their reference point, then it also just becomes about PR and marketing and catering to an audience as if it was consumers.
This is so important. And on a last note regarding boundaries, I think that it's also important to understand that when we lump things together, we lump the letters together in LGBT, but also inside of T, and you referred to this before, but to just emphasize on the fact that people think that the girl, the teenage girl who hates her breasts because she has body image issues because of society or because she was abused and says she's trans now or non-binary, is the same as the 60-year-old male who had children and a wife and loves putting on lingerie and watches sissy porn, is now calling himself a woman. And I say this because I think we also have to remember or discover or in another conversation maybe how porn culture has affected this whole thing. And they are the same, under the same trans umbrella as maybe the feminine boy who is maybe gay and just finds that, oh, maybe I have to question my sex because I'm too feminine. So I might be a girl and I have to get some hormones to treat my condition. And we put all these things together, which is really a dangerous, just a dangerous and harmful way of dealing with problems that arise at human suffering or any kind of social phenomenon that arises. And we just push lies, basically, with this idea that you can be in the wrong body or you have to be affirmed in your identity or your fantasies or whatever your fetish or fetish is, basically. And I think this is also the uncomfortable truth that people don't want to touch.
Yeah, and I think there is much of deliberate forgetfulness and performed naivete around this. Because these are things that we all know and most knew at least at one point. You know, there used to be reporting about transvestites, about men 40 plus who were putting on lingerie as a fetish. That was clearly spelled out. And this group of men did not disappear. And there's knowledge around what happens to young girls when they go through puberty and how vulnerable they are and how they are struggling with their sex, also with their sexual orientation, with the sexualization in society. And we know of anorexia and other phenomenon that are visible and manifest with exactly this group, with exactly this cohort. So there are so many things about this that we know, but it is deliberate forgetfulness to just completely pretend as if none of this has ever surfaced or had been discussed or, you know, would be shared knowledge of adult people in responsible situations. And then there is this performed naivete, as if I'm just approaching this topic and I'm just taking whatever I find on the surface. Mm-hmm. And what I find on the surface is, of course, how the trans activists package it. And it is highly irresponsible. So I really have no patience for this anymore. It would be different if we were maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago and people were just trying to make sense of this. But by now, whoever makes this a right or left issue is absolutely deliberately negligent. And whoever just takes this up as a human rights issue, trans activist demands are human rights issues, is equally irresponsible. So I think today there's no excuse, especially not for those who are in power and have responsibility. And I think especially not for those who claim to be feminists or from the left, because the betrayal is even deeper from that side.
Completely agree. Thank you so much for sitting down with me today, Faika, and the best of luck and,
thank you,
and everything, a lot of success with your work and Athena Forum.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks.